Reggae Uprising with your host, Danielle.
Greetings, Reggae Uprising podcast family, and welcome to another episode. If you are fresh and new to Reggae Uprising podcast, it is all about connecting people of the African diaspora through wisdom, overstanding, inspirational stories, all backed by a soundtrack of sweet reggae music. So each and every Wednesday, we feature a new guest who shares their journey, their wisdom, and their seven reggae selections for the upliftment and the empowerment of all. We do, however, occasionally have special series. So all throughout the summer, we had special series. So we had the Exodus Edition, we had the Self-Healing Series, and we had the Reggae Artist Spotlight. Now, previous special editions have also featured Mental Health Editions. In October, we also featured the Black Trios. So each week throughout October, we featured a different aspect of our past to bring it to light. So we focused on the Black Loves Trio, the Black Gold Trio, the Black Strategy Trio, and the Black Vision Trio. So we shared the monumental stories from our past in order to empower our future. So if you want to check out any of those, if you haven't already, all you need to do is subscribe wherever you're listening and go back. There's so many episodes of Reggae Uprising podcast, so much wisdom to be shared. Please, please, please do check out the special series alongside our regular feature of our guests that we focus on each and every Wednesday. You can also find all of our episodes via danielle.co.uk. So that's danielle.co.uk. As well as being your host for Reggae Uprising podcast, I am also a singer-songwriter of reggae soul conscious music. So if you want to check out any of my original works, you can get all of my music videos, all of my music, alongside all of my performance dates at danielle.co.uk, where all of my social media is also available if you want to stay up to date. You can also actually subscribe via danielle.co.uk as well. Right, I think it's about time we got started with today's guest's first selection, which is Money in My Pocket, Dennis Brown.
Money in my pocket, but I just can't get no love. Money in my pocket, but I just can't get no love. I'm praying for a girl to be my own. Soon as said she coming, but I don't.
Guest is historian who specializes in African American history, civil rights, slavery, black theology, Russian serfdom, English and colonial and post-colonial literatures, and black Bristol history. I would like to welcome Edson Burton. Greetings and welcome.
Greetings, Danielle.
Before we get started, we want to know why you chose that first selection that you just heard.
You know, I've always been a fan of Dennis Brown, and I think growing up, I grew up in a town called Bedford in Queen's Park, 50 miles north of London, next to Luton. And I think Dennis Brown was one of the first reggae singers that I remember, and it's also the quality and the tone of his voice. But to be honest, I guess it's like money in your pocket. It's the poetry of it, you know? It's that kind of contradiction between whatever you have, but that you can't buy love, the acquisition of that. And it's just, in a sense, the simplicity of that and the poetry of that and the tone of that, which has stuck in my mind. And one thing, I don't know if you mentioned, but I'm also a playwright. So I'm a writer, I write poetry, theatre, and for radio as well. And the last play we did, as a production, started up a new production company, and we played Money in Your Pocket as part of the Anansi story that we were telling. So yeah, the song has been a part of my life, really, part of growing up, a part of my connection with my siblings. There's 8 of us and more in the Caribbean. And it has nostalgic value, but it's also the vocal quality of it. And I remember an acoustic version that Dennis Brown did, and I came across that on YouTube, and it really just, the quality of his voice, you know, really struck me.
Now, as I ask all of my guests here at Reggae Uprising Podcast, as this show is all about connecting people of the African diaspora, can you tell us about your own heritage?
So I'm of Jamaican Navetian descent. So my mum was born in Nevis, and my dad was born in Jamaica, and they met in Bedford, and we grew up in a multicultural little town. I've been back to Jamaica, but I've not been to Nevis. And yeah, it was lovely growing up, but I say it's lovely growing up. It was kind of interesting because I didn't really always know what side the family, what influences I was getting, whether I was getting my dad's Jamaican stuff or whether I was getting my mum's stuff, because, you know, you're sort of melded together. It was only when I went to other towns and stuff and I would use certain expressions and people would go, "Well, we don't say that in Jamaica," and I realised it must have been a Navetian thing, my mum says. Yeah, and that whole thing around, not with the generation of us that was brought up here. So I was born in 1969, so that, yeah, a bit of a dinosaur to some. but for the generation that arrived here, there was this whole thing about small island and so on. So they were, in a sense, a mixed marriage, and they got it on both sides. You know, you don't marry Jamaicans, or you don't marry Navetians, don't marry small island people, don't, you know. So we always find ways to divide ourselves, and that was part of my... That was my part of my parents' generation, but not something that we carried on, except as jokes, you know, sometimes just ribbing people, but not seriously, not in the way that it was or had been.
So have you been able to find out more about your family history before your parents?
To be honest, it's what I find interesting. My mum says that her side of the family comes from Cuba. But I've, you know, getting my mum, I find that my mum's like other people of her generation. Some friends say that their parents tell them all about their heritage. My mum actually is one of those who doesn't tell me a lot. And trying to crack open her memories is not, yeah, it's not easy. But I think it's partly because she had quite a difficult childhood. She lost her mum very early, and her father died. So she was brought up by her siblings, and, you know, she didn't know it. Went in rural, not affluent at all, Nevis. So I think that's maybe one reason why she doesn't talk so much. But my dad, God rest his soul, he grew up in Bogwark in St. Catharines, and he told us that one of our ancestors was called Bakra Charlie. So... looking at my dad, looking at my mum, my grandmother, who I have met, but he didn't grow up with his grandmother, I can see that there is either a white or even Chinese heritage in the family. And Bakra, as some of the listeners will know, can either mean white man or overseer. So he left a plot of land, which my father's family lived on, in Bog Walk in St. Catharines. My older brother has done some, he's did the DNA test, and he traces us to a group of people in Central Africa, which is a bit of a surprise, really, but I think, again, transatlantic slave trade probably dispersed people very far and wide, so these things turn up where people were much more centrally based than we'd have imagined. So, funny enough, personally, I also think of myself as someone of probably of West African origin, and at some point in time, I'm kind of, I will find out. I've got Yoruba friends and Igbo friends and different people, so you look like you're from this group or from that group. And in some ways for me, I also think that knowing the Caribbean, knowing the African heritage and its complexity, that along my family line, in that DNA way, there'll be many different stories of different African groups that came together to create our family tree.
So you mentioned earlier some differences in some of the sayings that were used by your parents or elders. Can you remember any of those sayings, and do they equate to Jamaica or Nevis? Can you share any of those with us?
Well, you know, Cole never know the use of him peel to the butcher cut him off. If you don't catch quack, you catch him shirt. My mum, I can't remember much of my mum's sayings now that you've asked me. Ah, you put me on the spot, then you. My dad was full of them. But, you know, the thing is, I would say that it was more of a general love of language that I got from my dad. The way he would string things together, even if it was cursing. And there were sayings, but it was just, I think, the way, the kind of the poetry of Jamaican English, Jamaican Creole, Jamaican language that sticks with me.
Can you remember the kind of music that was played in your household when you were growing up? What were the favourite artists that your parents listened to?
Oh, dear. So, my mum listened to Jim Reeves, but she wasn't a great music listener until, in fact, we left home and my dad, my dad passed on. So it was Andy Williams and Jim Reeves for mum. Oh, dear. But dad listened to Al Capone. He had lots of blue beat records. Some of them, we didn't know the artists, but we knew of them. Then because with my siblings, we were all into really different things. So I didn't actually buy music until I left home because we had such different music listening that we were listening to growing up. My brother was listening to roots reggae, and I remember Burning Spear, the Abyssinians, the Heptones, of course, the Wailers. And those were the songs that my brother was playing. My brother was my oldest brother, who's 60 now, Nigel. Big up, Nigel. He was into... he was part of the sound system at the time, so that was that culture that was coming into the house, and he was a young Rasta and part of the Rasta community in Bedford. But my other sister was into metal, soft metal, Ariel Speedwagon and ZZ Top, and also Bhangra music. So I remember listening to Bollywood soundtracks coming through her bedroom. And my other sister was into Lovers Rock. Yeah, so she was really into Lovers Rock, and that brought a different flavour. My other brother was into funk music, so that's where I listened to, Rick James and Michael Jackson, and then Keith Sweat, when Keith Sweat started to hit the boards. So yeah, it was really eclectic. There wasn't one thing, you know. It was like a sound clash going on with different kinds of music playing at different times, and we were dipping in. And also, it was an early time in terms of black music in Britain. So my sister's stuff was also just like the pop that was available. So basically Rollers and that kind of stuff. And then we had this other music from America, and particularly from the Caribbean, that we were growing up and listening to. I remember UB40, actually, I Am a One in Ten, as being a song that really kind of resonated. So we had, like, the music that we listened to in the family, and then it was kind of strange to see reggae starting to be taken up in the British mainstream, but it's often by white bands. It wasn't, and then that black British reggae started to grow, and also you saw some of those bands take over. Remember Jackie Graham, Junior Giscombe, Karen Wheeler, obviously went on to Soul to Soul, but had another rock career as well. So yeah, it's so many different kinds of trends and stuff that I was listening to.
Speaking of music, we're going to move on to your next selection, which is Aswad, I Need Your Love. Can you tell us why you chose this selection?
Oh, it's I am a bit sentimental. I do love a good reggae record. I think as well for me, I think what I loved with Aswad is that they were doing rootsy stuff, but they also had this lover's vein. And I guess for me, as I got older, I identified a lot more with roots reggae. But I think I was always drawn to melody. And so I didn't identify with the American stuff. And I guess in a way, just what Lovers Rock was meant to do is it created a melody, romantic sound for black British generation. And the other thing with me for Aswad is that I kind of identified with them or respected them as Rastas. But then with this song, it kind of flipped the script a bit. It was a surprise. So it showed us their versatility. And again, I think as they became, this song was before they became commercial or commercially successful. So for me, it's part of an era of Aswad that often doesn't get celebrated and remembered. And, you know, I've got to be honest, respect to them and the success they've had, but it's part of the era that I prefer.
Here we go with Aswad, I Need Your Love.
Right. I need your love.
Of your childhood in the UK, what was your experience like? Was it a positive one? Were there negatives involved? Tell us of your own experience.
Yeah, it's so Bedford is a deceptive town in the sense that I've got friends who grew up in other towns and cities, and their experience of race and racism are very different from what my experience is. And I was shocked when people in Bristol, UK, that I've been living here now in Bristol since 1994, and they said, oh, you couldn't go into the town centre, you couldn't go clubbing because the teddy boys and the skinheads would chase you and you'd get kicking and you'd get a beating and that kind of thing, or you have to stick together because, and take those guys on. We didn't have no-go areas in Bedford, not when I was growing up. We had three skinheads who would be brave enough to walk around the town. And there was one pub with a British flag outside. And everybody said, oh, that's a skinhead pub. But, you know, nobody was afraid of them. We just were aware of that's what they were. So in a sense, I would say, like, in terms of that kind of visceral, in-your-face racism, it wasn't something that I experienced. But on the other hand, and what I would say I experienced was a lot of celebration of our differences. So I grew up going to, visiting my friend in the Gurdwara, my friends who were in the Sikh temple, friends in the Pentecostal churches. My mum took us to English denominations. So it was rich, and I realized now how much it how important it was, because I didn't learn about different cultures and different people of color through books and texts, but it was lived experience. I kind of knew the complexity of black religion, religious experience, because I lived it, you know, from family in Rasta, people in the Pentecostal, and then your Anglicans and Moravians. That was our lived experience. But the other side of things, which I realized as I got older, is how much I had lived through a period of the low expectations of for black kids and kids of color and working class kids. And it wasn't something that was stated, and it wasn't something that you understood in the bubble of the world that you were in. But it's just that our teachers didn't think we were going to achieve, we didn't think we were going to achieve, and it was kind of like fun to fail type thing. Nobody, it was cool in some ways, but there wasn't higher expectations of us. And we didn't understand our context as well. We didn't know about race and sociology and why we lived in a poor area, and that our parents were working in the lower earning jobs, and in order to make ends meet and do better, so many people's parents were doing huge amounts of overtime. Strong work ethic, but this has come out in the health conditions that so many of that first generation suffered. So in a way, yeah, it was fun, it was joyous, but it was also deceptive. And I went to a school that was mostly black, Asian, Italian. Bedford attracted people from all over the world. It was a town that people came to for heavy industry, brickworks, steelworks, and so on. Irish communities as well. But it was often what I kind of realized is that we were in the immediate heart of the city, because around the city is more the suburbs and people with affluence and so on. And, we all got along, but sometimes you get along, but you don't realize how different your experiences are from each other until you get older and realize that your friends have got, or people that you know who are middle class and so on, a certain kind of privileges and starts in life that you haven't had. But yeah, it was an interesting experience, because it was so different from that of my people that I've known growing up and elsewhere. And also, I grew up with, what I would say is, in terms of that negativity around blackness, I experienced that, some of the shocking things that people would casually call each other, like reference to each other from characters from Planet of the Apes, that episode, that series of Charlton Heston that was back in the day. Stuff now which we would understand to be internalized racism, but, we didn't have a language for it then. It was just jokes, but it's the heart of those jokes are dark. And I think, like so many people of that generation, roots of a huge and in some ways traumatic wake-up call, because suddenly roots on telly and you kind of heard about slavery in music, but it was on the screen and it was in discussion, and teachers were suddenly part of the enemy in a way that we had a language and what we thought was an understanding for. So that was a big wake-up call. But I've been asked interviewed a lot recently around this question of upbringing, and what's been really surprising to me is just how positive an influence Rastafarianism had been. My brother took me to different events, the 12 tribes gatherings throughout the country, and it was that it was that celebration of blackness, that dignity, the way in which people addressed each other, the revolutionary understanding of what it meant to be black, that I've realized that way before I went to uni and started to read different books, I'd already kind of reframed my way of thinking. And it was also very different from the kind of respectability ideas of the Pentecostal tradition, which I felt kind of was also a bit schizophrenic, because here we were as a black community that celebrated dance and celebrated the sensual and whatever, and then we deny these things on a Sunday, or they feel like they was part of another world, whereas I kind of felt like there was something more honest about Rastafarianism in terms of its recognition of what it meant to be the spirituality and the physicality and the whole need for that kind of unity inside the person, inside black culture, inside a black person, inside myself.
We are going to move on to your next selection, which is Beres Hammond, When They See Me With You. Why did you choose this selection?
Oh, that's between me and the selection. No, I've got to tell you the truth. I had a dance with a wonderful person, and it was very sweet, and it stuck with me. And this was the song that that moved us together. And so she's a very good friend now, and we had this dance, and it was a very special time. So this song was like a dedication to that, because it was playing at the time and it stayed with me in my life.
Here we go with Beres Hammond, When They See Me With You.
Some things were meant to be, so I've let it be. And stop worrying about it, long as we know.
Tell us the beginning of your journey into the world that you now live in your works.
So, two things really. I always wanted to study. I mean, I liked ideas at school. I didn't join in the whole, it was cool to keep your hand down and pretend that, you know, nothing was going on. I was the kid who always put his hand up. It's sometimes out of pity for the teacher, because when they asked a question, nobody would answer. So I liked ideas, and I also knew that I wanted a different life then and my parents wanted that for us all to, you know, do stuff and get out of town and not be involved in the factory work. But really, I always felt like I enjoyed ideas, I enjoyed language, and did sixth form, went to uni. And then after going to uni, I felt like I wasn't finished. And I discovered at uni, I did a literature degree, first of all, and I read, and it was the first time I read novels by black authors and poetry by black authors, and Toni Morrison's beloved Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. They kind of didn't, I wouldn't say, so if I was to go back a little bit further, reggae had already created in me, it was like an informal education that made me hungry to know more and also to develop myself. And also the restrictions of a small town, even a small town in which there is quite a, you know, significant black and people of colour population, the sense that there was a bigger world out there meant I wanted to find that, experience that, and develop myself in the process. I'd also been writing poetry and writing stories from when I was a kid. So I wanted to go to uni, and I didn't want to stay in the hometown. But after doing my literature degree, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to kind of get a job and then go back to uni again later on. And what I found was, and it's happened to me twice, is that I came out into recessions and still quite narrow opportunities that were available. So I did my MA at the School of Oriental and African Studies, and that completely opened my mind again to not thinking about the black communities in the diaspora, but also thinking in a much more, open my eyes and introduced me to an understanding of African philosophy, history of the relationship between slavery in Africa and in European slavery, transatlantic, and also literature by African writers, Chinua Achebe, Things Fall Apart, Bessie Head, Question of Power, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Devil on the Cross. Some of the texts that really stuck out for me. And so in a sense, I then went on to do a PhD, and I finished my, it was on Church of England and Race Relations. I wasn't going to do a literature, I wasn't going to do a history degree, PhD. I was going to do something in literature, so I thought. But actually, I came across a wonderful opportunity that I thought was too good to pass up. And I was quite keen on history, but it was like, if you got several loves, it was love number two. And when I came to Bristol, I hadn't really been part of a black community through those years of studying in London. It was kind of like a student community and a student black community, of course, as well. But more like a student community, not like a residential, normal people team. And then when I moved to Bristol, that changed. And from 98, well, no, really, from the time that I moved to Bristol, I started to hang out at the Kumba Centre, which is a black arts project there. And while I was living across town and I started a family, I was actually socialising and getting to know people in the community, people in the culture scene, and so on. So that when I finished my PhD, I stayed in Bristol, and not just that, but I started to write at the same time. Yeah, I started to write radio plays and theatre and other stuff. And that also meant that for me, I've also started to work in the community a lot more. So now that has kind of led to me being in this position where I work within the culture sector. I curate and lead history projects of different kinds. Looking at a project at the moment called The Art of Resistance, Back Creativity and Protest. I'm also working on a film script, which is around events in Bristol's black history, and a range of other things. But what I feel has been important for me is that I've I move between different worlds, so I'm not born in Bristol, but I know quite a few Bristolians, but also I see different perspectives. I see the different perspectives here, that there's not one perspective on stuff. You know, there's people who work in culture and people who work in the arts and people who, you know, don't go outside those things but have those concerns and interests and are keen to know more about Black history and art and culture. I don't often get those opportunities. So I feel like that role of being connected and in between has been important for me creatively, but also in terms of thinking of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and who I'm doing it for.
So your next selection is Bob Marley, Redemption Song. Can you tell us why you chose this selection?
Bob Marley, you know, there's a danger of sometimes you can be a victim of your own success, and there's so much of Bob Marley's music that is part of my consciousness that I've grown up with, and also, I guess, in a way, so many people have come up with, that sometimes the radicalism of his voice and the intensity and intelligence of his lyrics can almost kind of be lost in the sense that people just encounter it all the time. But for me, Redemption Song is will always be eternally special. And I just think even those opening lines, those opening lyrics just say so much. And they say, and also I think it's a song that's like a shorthand for understanding Black history. I think one of the things that has helped, that continues to happen in Bristol, when Black community, we talk about, you know, the relationship between slavery, racism, and underdevelopment. People say, oh, but it, you know, that happened 200 years ago, da-da-da-da. Redemption Song kind of literally in that short space of time tells you not only about that journey, but also its connection to today. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. You know, it's such a, it's, as a person like myself who loves poetry and loves words, it's the height of succinctness and complexity at the same time. Yeah, it's a haunting song. Haunting and powerful. Yeah, and you know, and it's a hopeful song. Yeah. It's like stripping, when you strip everything away, as you said, it's all I've ever had is a redemption song. And it is still at the same time a defiant song, but a song of healing, you know. Sometimes you have to kind of know that you fight a war and you resist things, but in order to come to a healthier place within yourself and with others. Yeah, really special song.
Here we go with Bob Marley, Redemption Song.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom, 'cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs.
If there was some changes made to the education system and Black history was taught across the UK, and you were only allowed to teach five aspects of Black history, what would they be?
Oh, you're not easy. I think it's really important that people understand the pre-colonial African civilizations. But my focus personally would be less on Egypt, more on West Africa, more on the Congo area. And also with that, though, I think it's really important that we reconceptualize things that I think often don't get addressed. So we need to think differently about civilization and technology and so on. Because there are a wealth of different African civilizations within the continent and within the regions that I mentioned. But also the sophistication of people's social organization, their religion, the cosmologies, all this needs to be taught and understood, not as a reaction. And the key thing for me is not a reaction to Europe, but because there is something unique and special that every region, every people have to teach the world. And I think that, it's about understanding that, even through the cosmologies, even through dance, even through understanding that the body and the mind is to be celebrated as part of a divine relationship. So that's one thing. I think that's one thing, or is that several? Then also, I think we definitely need to look at the transatlantic slavery. But within that, I think we need to look at it in the complexity of Black resistance and Black agency, so that we understand that within the power context, there were people that exploited people on all sides, but that the resistance on slave ships, on the islands, and also through the Black abolitionist movement, people like Frederick Douglass that don't get mentioned, Harriet Tubman, they are pioneering world figures of resistance that are not just part of the thing is that when they just get placed in, oh, it's part of a Black story, and so we can put it in brackets, they're pioneering figures of Black resistance worldwide for people who have been oppressed. And they've innovated ways of resistance that I think often gets ignored. So I would also, in that in mind, look at resistance strategies and how resistance strategies today, we think about social media, activist mobilization, so much of that, you even think of the civil rights movement, have been, in a sense, pioneered by Black resistance. So I'd look at that too. 19th century, people in England in particular need to understand the colonial history much better. They don't understand why people have come here, because I think the sense of colonialism and what it meant for us and what it meant for other people who were colonized is not fully understood. So people saying we want to keep our borders, but they opened the borders in the first place by mashing up places. So it's part of the education of British people to understand that, in a sense, when you build an empire, you change your own country. So what does empire mean? How did it change us? How it changed them? Why is sugar and tea and coffee, these things that just seem to appear, the relationships that they created? So that our histories are kind of intertwined in a complex way. I think when I was growing up, what I really could have benefited from was understanding power and structure. I think it's And that would have helped my self-esteem as a young black person to understand that what structural racism, structural inequality means. And I think this can be done for young people, but you just need to do it in a way, of course, and in a language that's understandable and relatable. But it's much better than us growing up, as we did, thinking that somehow it's something we've done wrong, or our parents couldn't get their act together. That's why we're in the poorest parts of town and we're doing the worst jobs and stuff and so on. So then it was only as I was older that I understood racism in England and why people were, in a sense, placed and stuck in those positions deliberately and how those structures get inherited and so on. So I think it's part of understanding that things are not accidental, they are created. That, I think, is very empowering, especially if you place the story alongside these stories of resistance I mentioned before, but what black parents and people of all generations, not just the parents, what they've been, how they've responded, how they've pushed back against that and challenged. And I think we need to look at black music in a more, and culture in a more, in a more complex way. You know, I think people don't often understand the gift of black culture, what that expressiveness means, the genius of that, but also where it comes from. It's just, and obviously having African friends, and people will tell me where, you know, the field hollers come from, the Bambara people, and polyrhythms and drumming and the talking drum and how this thing survives. Now they're in our sound system culture and so on, and we see people responding to the heartbeat, you know, and the heat and the bass and so on. But what we do isn't always respected. So I think, in a sense, without destroying it and turning it into something like an archive that's dead, but seeing it as living, I think we also need to celebrate and understand the intelligence and genius of black culture and black cultural production.
With that said, obviously folk tales are part of our oral history that gets passed down. Is there any wisdom and knowledge that you could share about African, Caribbean folk tales, where people can start in terms of folk tales if they don't have the elders to pass that down to them? Are there, you know, are there certain folk tales or the encompassing names of those folk tales that they can research for themselves so that they can pass that on to the next generation and it doesn't get lost?
Yeah, there's some great collections. There's a guy called Philip Sherlock. There's Miss Lou, Louise Bennett. Her collections of Anansi stories are in a Jamaican vernacular. If you can get your hands on Louise Bennett's work, that would be fantastic. There's a range of other publications with Caribbean folklore, and there are collections. What I would say is that understand that storytelling and the folklore were meant different things in different places, but they were ways of teaching. They were ways of teaching, and like parables, that would stand you in good stead in moments of crisis. And so they're important to know because they are a different body of wisdom that has been passed down and also still lives within us. But we don't always understand that it's a body of wisdom and how important it is. Sometimes when you're going to do something, you need that restraining voice or you need that counseling ear. And remembering the stories are around that counseling ear. You know, sometimes Anansi's fullness is not to create a character just to entertain, but to say, oh, you see what you're doing, you're acting like an Anansi. But at the same time, his bravery, and he changes between the African context and the Caribbean context. In the African context in particular, he's a higher status figure, who also does his mischief, but there are times when he's a higher status figure. And why he survives is because sometimes he has to outwit the most powerful, whether they're gods or whether they're big animals. So you can see that if you are in an argument with someone who's more powerful with you or in a situation with them, then how do you use your smarts to outwit them? But also, how do you show someone a thing in their life that they can't see in a way that doesn't cause offense? So that's the other important element of storytelling as well. It's ways of addressing people who might have a higher status than you or whatever, or may feel vulnerable and they can't take it if you tell them straight up, and you use a story. So there's lots of different, stories are available. There are publications available, and if you're in Bristol, then please come down to the Bristol Old Vic this December, because this is, unlike the other show before, this one is definitely children-friendly. and see what we're doing and how we use the stories. But they're there, but they're so important. And, you know, I say this again, and I hope your listeners, I hope many of your listeners already know this, but I think there's been a myth that everything was lost in slavery that took away our culture and so on. I think what happened is they confused our culture, and we didn't always know the roots of where expressions and stories and songs came from. Sometimes people in the Spanish-speaking islands, you know, Puerto Rico, Brazil, not just islands, of course, but on the continent, Brazil, Cuba, their traditions, like Santeria, the religion, Candomblé, another religion as well, their traditions were preserved in a strong way, whereas under the Protestant British, there was an attempt to mash up those traditions much more, but they still survived. You know, big drum dances in St. Vincent, or even John Canoe, and celebrations in Jamaica, which is, again, came from the 18th century and so on. So these things are there. They weren't destroyed. There is the link there. And what a bit of research can help you to do is to make sense of these practices that are still around. Some people in Jamaica will still remember and still practice, of course, Kumina. And that's, of course, an expression of a Congolese tradition that's still around today.
We are now going to move on with your next selection, which is Jimmy Cliff, Many Rivers to Cross. Why did you choose this selection?
It's Jimmy, Many Rivers to Cross, I guess. I was talking earlier about, you know, go-to things when you're in moments of crisis. And there is something about the power of the song. It's like a lament. It's just like a lament out to the world, the sense of exile. And, of course, in a way, growing up in England, there's always a sense of not quite belonging, a sense of exile. And then, personally, as a boy growing up in Bedford, I didn't always feel like I fitted in and belonged. And I think sometimes people who are creative often carry this sense of not quite fitting in, not quite being on the same frequency. And then there's moments in your life, you know, when you experience things. But Many Rivers to Cross has that power of just kind of articulating your one's feeling. For me, it's like the soul in a song, the blues and soul in a song. And I think like soul nowadays often means complicated singing and the curlicues and whatever. But Jimmy Cliff, in how he inhabits that song, and the pain of that feeling of exile, and, you know, us being children of exile through the diaspora and a enforced migration, I think this song captures that feeling.
Here we go with Jimmy Cliff, Many Rivers to Cross.
Find
In your works as a playwright and trying to obviously push the African story within your works, have you felt any opposition? Was it a difficult thing to try and put those works to the forefront? What was your experience with in doing that?
I can't say I've experienced opposition. And my work just jumps around from different concerns, but in some ways they're not really different concerns. There's things that I'm drawn to. So I've got I did a series for Radio 4 recently called Deacon, and he's an otherworldly spirit person between the living world and the dead world, and it's a curse, basically. He turned his back on his gods, embraced Christianity, and then the slave owners burned him and his congregation alive, and since then, rather than die, he was cursed. But on the other hand, preserved as an instrument. So I've, in a way, explored really different kinds of aspects of Black experience, some of it historically based. I did a play years ago on Radio 4 called Rebel Woman, which was about Nanny of the Maroons, and that was commissioned in 2007 as part of the commemoration of the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade. But I've also written plays about, contemporary things. A young man who converts to Islam and his family are worried that he's going to become a jihadist. But in fact, he was converted to Islam because he saw something that was much less hypocritical than what he was experiencing from his father, who was a Pentecostal preacher. And that is not a comment. No, Pentecostal preachers, just this particular set up in this story. And I try and bring in folklore as well, or elements of it. So, short story called The Gods Are Merciful, where a person throws himself overboard of a slave ship and finds himself passing through different kinds of life forms in an attempt to be reunited with the woman that was enslaved with him. And it takes, centuries, but he doesn't know it because he's going through different bodies and life form and species and stuff. So I wouldn't say that I've experienced opposition. Probably what I would find is that sometimes I want to be bold and I want to push things sometimes, and you're always doing this thing of navigating what the platform is and what the opportunity is. Sometimes I feel like certain things need to be done more subtly, and some things they need the rawness of them. So it's a work in progress to get there and feel that I've expressed all that I need to express. At the moment, what I don't like is this. Some people are kind of think, oh, there's so much slavery in films, and oh, there's so much this, and I've written about slavery in film, part of my film collective. I'm part of the film collective, and there's a lot less than people think. In fact, there's very little. And a few years back, there were over 2,000 films about the Holocaust, and counting. So I feel like, and I understand it, but it's such a trauma that we have audiences, and I have friends who say, oh, I don't want to see that, or they call it poverty porn. But I feel like there's a way for things to be done that are not just for shock value, but I also feel it's about honouring our ancestors, honouring the people who never had a chance to speak for themselves, who died with their lives curtailed, erased, all those things, that I feel that their voices need to be heard. And as a writer, as a historian, that's the very least I can do.
So for any listeners that are wanting to become a playwright, wanting to write for radio, wanting to write screenplays, what advice would you give? What little things you wish people had told you before you got into it? Or what do they need to be aware of?
So they need to be self-critical. They need to find people who they can trust, who will give them feedback. And you don't want, and the two things to be wary of is your friends who say that everything you do is brilliant, or the red eye person who tells you that it's not that good, but it's because they're jealous. Good critical feedback is so important. I think sometimes with singing, it's obviously easier. Somebody can tell you you're out of key. You know, with writing, it can seem like interpretation. But there are rules. There are things that make stories work better when you know them. And there's things that, be surprised. Surprise yourself and surprise the audiences. Try and find your own voice as well. There's a lot, it takes a while because we watch so much, we see so much. But actually, we all have a story. It's a cliche, we all have a story that's unique. But we also have a voice, and sometimes you think, okay, does this sound like somebody else? How do I see this thing? You know, there's an idea that two people do the same sum, math sum in a different way. Finding your voice, finding your own way of writing. Don't be afraid to try characters and try out situations. And persevere. You know, the thing is, writing is about faith. You have to have faith in yourself that where you are today is not where you're going to be tomorrow and the day after and the year after. That you're on a journey and you start somewhere and you just have faith in your improvement to get to that next thing. Storytellers don't have to go to university. They don't have to have PhDs. Sometimes that can actually be in the way. It's about being able to tell a story, understand characters, and learn the craft of writing. And there are things to learn, teach the craft that are out there. But at the same time, don't write by numbers because you've discovered a formula. You know, think about stories that, and don't think about grand stories. Think about real stories to you. And sometimes what people do is they avoid the story that's right under their nose. So they'd rather talk about, the neighborhood and what's going on in the neighborhood. But they won't tell a story about dementia in their family. They won't tell a story about their girlfriends and things like that. So I think as black listeners, as black people, we need to sometimes shut down the noise of the world and realize that as 360 people, actually very little of our lives get told. You know, you can live in a certain urban area and, you know, there's crime and there's this and so on. But actually 90% of people have got nothing to do with that. And even the people who do often have more complex lives. They've got their mums, they've got their kids, they've got their, you know, partners. So we're only telling a tiny part of our stories. Don't look for the big stories. You know, think about telling a story that's powerful and under your nose, and then bring in those other elements to keep people engaged and interested. And be truthful with yourself as well. Some people might want to write history. Read different people. Read people that annoy the hell out of you. And try and synthesize, pull together those different voices, because there's always a teaching and a learning.
We are going to move on with your next selection, which is Barry Biggs' Sideshow. Why did you choose this selection?
Just pure nostalgia. Coming home at the end. So we had a club in Bedford called the West Indian Club. And this was, you know, back in the day when black people didn't have a chance to go other places, and before the clubs started to play, you know, soul and Mayor Groove and wherever else. So we had a West Indian pub, and it had a little dance floor, and you had a one turntable DJ. Lucky Harry, God rest his soul, was one of the DJs I remembered at the time. And Barry Biggs would be one of the Sideshow Begin, was just brought back memories of that time and growing up in Bedford and listening to that song. And I guess I love the opening, the intro, and his falsetto, which I didn't really hear at the time. Now I hear it a lot more in Lovers, but It's one of the first time, again, I was mentioning some of the other singers, that I got to hear those unique voices in reggae.
Here we go with Barry Biggs.
Step right up, hurry, hurry, before the show begins, my friends. Stand in line, get your tickets, I hope you will attend. It'll only cost you 50 cents to see what life has done for those like you and me. See the man with the broken heart, you see that he is sad, he's hurt so bad.
So bad, so bad.
See the girl who has lost the only love she's ever had. There's got to be no sadder show to see, no doubt about it, satisfaction's guaranteed. So let the sideshow begin, hurry, hurry, step right on in. Can't afford to pass it by, guaranteed to make you cry.
Before we get on to how people can find you and the different projects that you're working on and your future project, should I say, I'm going to do a couple of quick fire questions, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
So they are very simple, but I think very powerful. So I want three answers, one for men and one for women. In terms of women, could you give three historical figures that you feel that every woman should know about, and then three male historical figures that every man should know about in terms of their own empowerment? Yeah, I know. I had to do it at the end as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, three women, Sojourner Truth, Claudia McKay, and Louise Bennett. Yeah, Louise Bennett. There's more, but I'll go there for now. And then in terms of men, Frederick Douglass. Prince and Marcus. You're not gonna leave in my ums and ahs, are you?
If you want me to take them out, I can take them out.
I think Bayard Rustin is a civil rights organizer. Paul Robeson, actually. Paul Robeson.
Okay. And
yeah.
Seeing as you answered that, can you give us your three most life-changing books that you ever read?
Okay, so Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Beloved, and A Question of Power by Bessie Head.
Okay.
Do you want, I can say a little something as to why.
Yes, go on.
Yeah, so Ralph Ellison, his character goes from southern states, and he goes through this kind of Booker T. Washington type thing. And then he goes to the north and he meets the Garveyites. Then he moves on. He goes to the socialists, white socialists, sort of leading and trying to galvanize black communities. And he always feels like there's something missing, there's something not quite right. And what that did for me was often I felt like I've seen different movements to see what they have to offer, but there's something not finished or there's voices that get excluded. And all they're compromising in terms of the power system and fully taking it on. And it's a quite a sad book in the end because he doesn't know where to proceed. He just hides. Oh, spoiler alert, sorry. But in terms of just understanding the complexity of what black politics has been and how we have tried to find ourselves within that, also how we've ended up being divided and played, instead of learning that actually each of these things have an offer, but there is also an absence, and we need to be honest and clear about what's missing. Beloved was just, I mean, just was some of the most beautiful and tragic writing that, in terms of the trauma of slavery, but the possibility of healing, ghosts, haunting, how you can be haunted by trauma, almost in a literal way. I think Toni Morrison, I put that book down and it was like, you know, you're vibrating on a different frequency of understanding. Super powerful. And Bessie Head was about mental health, but also about evil. And she says the word, people do evil thinking they're doing good. And very few people think that they're doing evil. And, you know, if you think of the Nazis, you think about people and some people involved in the slave trade, you know, that they actually think they're doing a good. It's a way of rationalizing the evil that they're doing, I'm sure. But Bessie Head, Question of Power, South African, right, Botswana woman exiled to South Africa, or other way around, sorry. Fantastic book. But was so important for me in terms of my experiences of mental, of people very close to me with mental health stuff, but seeing how that's so much part of not just their individual pain and struggle, but also part of a collective traumatic black experience on the continent and in the diaspora.
Thank you so much for answering those. I know they were hard questions in terms of narrowing those people and those books down. So I really do appreciate you answering that. Can you tell us where people, where our listeners can find you, the, like I said, the works you have coming up and your future plans as well, please?
Yeah, so at the moment I've got a collection of poetry called Seasoned, which should be available still. I've got my radio series called Deacon, which is on Audible. Some of my other work on Radio 4 will pop up now and again when it gets rebroadcast, but Deacon series by Edson Burton is available on all Audible. There's another Deacon, but it's not me, and not my team. And in terms of other projects, a book called Vice and Virtue that I've done, there's essays here and there. My future plans, I've got, where do I start? I'm working on a screenplay. I guess my big thing that I'm looking forward to is bringing back my work around Frederick Douglass. I wrote a piece for Bristol Old Vic. We brought people onto the streets and I had different people playing Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist. It's very powerful, brought really different people together to think not just about Frederick Douglass, but also about today and race and so on. But I want to work on my Afrofuturist project, The Last Blues Song, A Lost Afronaut, which is based on the idea of a group of people from the African diaspora that go off into space and start a whole new world. They land on a new planet and start a new world, but they deliberately lose all memory of Earth. And the reason for doing it is because they think that there is so much of the internalized troubles of colonialism, slavery, and so on, that to truly begin again, they start on another Earth, another planet. So that's a really big project, and sometimes it's, I think, where am I going to start with it? So, but next year I've got so many different things that I'm juggling and working on. But yeah, that's a big project I want to work on and collaborate with. Really, it's Because what we want to do is think about what would the music be. So what would happen if you put dub through 1,000 years of history? How would that be? What if there were people doing dub music who were talking to people who practiced Santeria, who were also talking to people who were in the gospel tradition, and all this melded together to create a new kind of music, and you threw that into the future. So I'm not a musician. I do holler in a band, but, you know, it'd be wonderful if people come together and join us on this journey. There's a little team of us, and we had a bit of a sabbatical from this project, but I really, really want to get working on it. So I'm available on most social media platforms, but I haven't built a website yet. It's a bit crazy. I just, because I get contacted through all those channels. But I'm available at Edson Burton on Facebook, on Instagram, eBurton70, and I'm on Twitter, Edson Burton. And I do get back to people.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. And everybody I know is going to be searching out your works if they don't already know already. You have so much works that they might know some of it, but they didn't know all of what you just said. So I'm sure all of the listeners will show their support. But we do have one final selection before we go, which is Fabian Prophecy. Can you tell us about why you chose this final selection?
Oh, gosh. So having been brought up in... So I went to church. Some kind of Christian. I believe in God, spiritual paths, but also I believe like we all find our own way to spiritual, and my conduit was through Christianity. But I try and live a life that's consistent rather than set myself up for things that may not do. So that's a bit of a long spiel, but the thing is that with Prophecy by Fabian, that sense of warning, that sense of the times that we're in, the urgency of the song and the gravity of that song, that bass line and the horns are just... there's something majestical about it. It feels Old Testament, you know. There is almost something perfect about Prophecy in terms of what it's conveying and what it's saying. And so it's funny enough, when you asked me for this selection, and I listened to Funk and Soul and everything, but I was like, yes, Fabian. And also the look of the band as well, the Righteous Dread look, and so stamped on my memory, you know, part of my growing up. And as I say, very so important to my sense of self that maybe already before going to university and studying formally set me up in a positive way to think about black history and black possibility. So, a big part of that. And that resistance sound. But again, just the way that song is arranged is just splendid.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, your wisdom, your insight into your works as well. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you ever so much too. And look me up, all listeners out there, and I will get back. And thanks ever so much.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As you know, this podcast is all about connecting people through inspiration and wisdom. So if you would like to connect with Edson Burton, all of his links are in the description for you. If you would like to connect with me, maybe you want to feature on a future episode of this podcast, or maybe you want to connect with me musically, or maybe you're working on a project you feel you would like me to collaborate with you on, all you need to do is go to daniel.co.uk, that's daniel.co.uk, and you can get in touch with me via the contact page there, and also all of my social media links are there as well. I hope you have a wonderful week. Make sure you're back here next Wednesday for a fresh and new episode. But until then, I'm going to leave you with the high vibrations of Fabian Prophecy. As always, blessed love.